Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, the podcast where we invite historians to force mythology over the sea to sky. The podcast that I dare say may even be invited by Parliament to invade. I am your regular host, Paul Bavel, and I am here with my loyal co-host and glorious revolutionary himself, Kyle Glover.
Hello, everyone.
How are you doing today, Kyle?
I should have said that in Dutch. Never mind. Hang on. Carry on.
Well, this week, dear Ragers, we are joined once again by a return Rager, proving yet again that it's our most polite, civil and quiet guests that have the most rage. For this week, we welcome back historian, author of La Garde Écossaise, The Life of John Hamilton, and host of its accompanying podcast, Dr. Kirstine McKenzie. Kirstine, welcome back to History Rage.
Thank you so much for having me back.
You are more than welcome. So we last spoke back all the way back in Series 4 when you came on to rage quite convincingly that it's the War of Three Kingdoms, not the English Civil War. A motto that we've really taken to heart now. But that was just as La Garde Écossaise was coming out. So how's that gone in the year or so since?
It's gone really quite well. I've had a lot of positive feedback on the book and I've got another couple of books in the pipeline. And yeah, it's gone really quite well.
So you're going to turn into the 17th century's answer to Bernard Cornwell then?
Probably, yeah.
God! It's about time Sharp stopped getting the glory.
So it's going to be about 7 books, and they're going to cover the whole swathe of 17th century history. So with regards to John Hamilton's book, we concentrate on military history in Britain, Ireland, and across Europe and France and Spain, and the 30 Years' War in Germany. So it covers quite a lot. Mm. In fact, I've had to split his biography into two because I have to cover quite a bit. But it focuses on what we call the general crisis in the 17th century. So we look at, for example, the 1641 Irish Rebellion, which I will mention later today in the rage. It also focuses on the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, particularly in the Scottish Highlands and royalism. And then it moves on to the 30 Years' War, or the tail end of the 30 Years' War. And then it moves to sort of Barcelona and the Catalans and the revolt that was happening there. And then we eventually end up in Louis XIV's France when John Hamilton is serving under Cardinal Mazarin and Louis XIV as the head of a secret elite unit, which is tasked in protecting the king and innocence from certain death. And his opponent in this book is William of Orange, who I will also be talking about today.
Right then. So, given that we've covered a taste as to the subject that we're coming at today, let's get right into the rage question. Slightly different rage question that you've had before, but for your return rage, Kirstine, what is pissing you off today?
It's just this idea that the 1688 revolution was bloodless. The amount of times I still read this in books makes me extremely angry. The 1688 revolution was not bloodless. And it's because a civil war raged across England, Scotland and Ireland during this period. Particularly in Scotland and Ireland, it was pretty brutal. In England, it wasn't so bad, as I will go on to explain. But people did die. It wasn't very pretty at all. So basically, just what I would like to rage is that the 1688 revolution was not bloodless.
Okay. Right then. So let's get a bit of background first of all then, because the 1688 revolution, at least in England, is popularly known as the Glorious Revolution. I would possibly say it's neither of those things, but it's not my rage, it's yours. Why does it start to get that term and keep it till even now?
Well, to understand the term and where it comes from, we really have to go back to the 17th century. So I want to take you back there, and I want you to imagine yourself as a London merchant. You're 68 years old. You're a Protestant dissenter. You believe in the supremacy of Parliament. You believe that Stuarts are bringing Catholicism back, and you're not very happy with it at all. You are, as being 68 years old, you are at an age group where you fought during the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, which was horrific. It was utter carnage. You lost friends and family. And what people often forget about the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, and here's maybe quite a shocking statistic or point for your listeners, is that more people died in the Wars of the Three Kingdoms in Britain than died in the First World War.
I never thought of that, yeah.
More British people died in the Wars of the Three Kingdoms than British soldiers died in the First World War. It was utter carnage. So when you've got, in 1688, if you're a London merchant living in London, and you've got William of Orange, who lands at Torbay in November 1688, and you've got James II, who's going to meet him with an army in the West, you are sitting there watching and waiting to see what happens. You are terrified that England is going to be pulled into another civil war. But interestingly, the full-scale battle between William of Orange and James II in the West, in England at least, never happens. And what happens is that James flees the country in December 1688, and William of Orange comes to London, and I know I'm skipping over a lot here in terms of events, but William of Orange broadly gets accepted by the English establishment and gets crowned king, with his king, and his wife Mary gets crowned queen. And the English establishment largely accepts this as being how it should be. Now, if you're an English merchant who's lived through the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, you're breathing a sigh of relief that England has avoided another bloody civil war. So when they call it the Glorious Revolution, it's not because it was bloodless. It was because, compared to the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, a lot less blood was shed in England. And I have to emphasise in England, okay? And I will go on to explain this in more detail. But what I also want to emphasise about England as well is that blood was shed in England as well, but not to the same extent as the Wars of the Three Kingdoms. So the Glorious Revolution was not bloodless. Just compared to the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, it was a lot less bloody in terms of casualties and deaths.
Can you give us an idea of... Yeah, can you give us an idea of, you know, the sort of deaths that we're looking at, the sort of numbers compared to... Well, in fact, essentially, let's have a look at that statistic that you mentioned of the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, first of all, because... As I understand it, the First World War wipes out about 1.5% of the English population.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's quite a lot, but I'd imagine by 1914 to 1918, you're actually starting from a lot more people than you would have been starting from in 1642.
Yeah.
So how do the populations compare? And we're talking actually more soldiers die.
Yeah, more per head of the population. So it's one in every five, one in every six people die. In Ireland, there's a huge chunk of the population that is comparable with the Irish famine, for example.
Yeah.
So you're dealing here with massive, massive casualties on a huge scale. And it's quite a brutal conflict. But getting back to the term Glorious Revolution and what it actually means as well, there's another second meaning that has to be looked at, which is that we have to recognise that the Glorious Revolution as a term is based on perspective. So it's, as a term, it is telling the story of the 1688 revolution from a particular perspective. And that particular perspective is from the point of view of William of Orange, and it is against James II. So the Whig interpretation of the Glorious Revolution is enshrined as part of the unwritten constitution of the United Kingdom. And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to quote the historian Evelyn Cruikshanks in her introductory text to the Glorious Revolution, and she sums it up perfectly, and I quote, "The Whig interpretation of the Glorious Revolution as enshrined as part of the unwritten constitution by T.B. Macaulay in his History of England from the Ascension of King James II, published in the mid-19th century, laid down that it was responsible for political liberty, constitutional stability, economic progress, and religious freedom. For Macaulay, King James II was the villain and William of Orange the hero." Now, I want to unpack that paragraph for a minute here. So for centuries after the revolution in 1688, Whig historians saw these events as part of Britain's journey towards parliamentary democracy, towards our unwritten constitution. And they do have a point in that respect. So the 1688 revolution secured a free parliament, the Protestant monarchy, and a Protestant line of succession. It also restrained the monarchy by law, but also Parliament by a Bill of Rights. Also, the revolution meant a delivery from popery and slavery as Protestants saw it under King James II. And because King James II left the way that he did, he fled. He didn't put up a fight. He fled in December 1688. It's seen as a relatively peaceful transition of power. So that's also obviously where the term Glorious Revolution comes from. Now, William of Orange is invited to take the throne by the Immortal Seven in a letter, and he's invited over, and that's how he ends up landing at Torbay on the 5th of November 1688. Again, it's all very sort of peaceful in that sense, to a point. Okay, this is what the Whigs believe. They focus on this letter from the Immortal Seven and go, oh, look, it was peaceful. We invited him over. Okay, but I will talk about this in a minute because it's not as peaceful as you might think it is. And according to Whig historians, William has no self-interest in the revolution whatsoever. He's doing this to deliver Britain from Popish tyranny. And he's the deliverer of the country. There's no self-interest in this revolution whatsoever. There's nothing in it for him. He's doing it for the Protestants of Britain.
Now, what I know of William of Orange, he doesn't do anything unless there's something in it for him. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in that sense, it's the Whig perspective is very much pro-William of Orange, where he's the saviour of the country. He's come to liberate Britain from the tyrannical King James II. However, and this is what I want to emphasise, this does not mean that everyone freely recognised this transition of power and freely accepted what was going on, because armed force was a constant factor in the 1688 revolution, as I will explain later. The response to William's accession to the throne was that James II's supporters, the Jacobites, rose up to support James's claim to the throne, and because they saw it as rightful and just. And this resulted in a civil war across the three Stuart kingdoms. So the 1688 revolution was certainly not bloodless.
So if I'm sitting there as a 68-year-old merchant in London that's a Protestant sympathiser and veteran of the Parliamentarian Army, I've actually seen this bloodless revolution start another civil war.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But because you're in England, it's minimal, as I will go on to explain. But before I go on to that, there is a third meaning of the Glorious Revolution that I want people to understand. Because we're taking a Three Kingdoms look at it, I think it's important to acknowledge the importance of William of Orange to a certain section of Irish society or British society, or certain section of society in Ireland is probably the best way to put it.
Yeah.
And we've got to look at it through their eyes to understand why for them William of Orange is a hero. Okay. And I think it's important for us to understand this. So in the 17th century, Ireland was one country. It was a united country. The Northern Ireland didn't exist. It was, but Protestants were a minority within that kingdom, particularly in the north. There had been a plantation in Ireland which started in 1609 and invited English and Scottish settlers to come in and settle on land that had been confiscated by the Crown from Irish Catholics. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So all these English settlers are coming in and Scottish settlers are settling on this land and the Irish are being dispossessed. Now, a lot of resentment from the Irish builds up. And in 1641, this resentment explodes into violence and fury. And it's called the 1641 Rebellion. And thousands of English and Scottish settlers were killed. Okay, not as many as the English propaganda would have you to believe. The numbers, when the news got to London and it got to the printing presses, the numbers were greatly exaggerated. But thousands of English and Scottish settlers died in this rebellion. And when things after the Wars of the Three Kingdoms began to settle back down again, the Protestant population of Ireland couldn't really trust the Catholic population. They were always on edge for another 1641 to happen.
Mm-hmm.
This is very important. So let me fast forward to 1685. So Charles II dies and James II inherits the throne. Now, to stand up for James II, he had this policy that he thought would work, which was to allow Catholics and Protestant dissenters have a right to hold office. James II believed in toleration. So he wanted Protestant dissenters and Catholics to be equal with their Anglican counterparts. It sounds all very nice and lovely, but what actually happened between 1687 and 1688, particularly in Ireland, was that Catholics flooded into the administration in Dublin and they ended up getting all the top posts. And the Protestant dissenters didn't have any posts at all.
Mm.
And what happened was that the Protestant dissenters are seeing all these Catholics get top posts and they're thinking, oh, well, we could be in trouble here, because they're thinking about 1641. And what doesn't help is that some within the administration in Dublin actually ask King James II to roll back the plantation of Ulster, which has been happening gradually since 1609, which would result in the dispossession of English and Scottish settlers from the lands that they've been living on. So you can see that there's this build-up of potential problems with this.
Mm.
So what happens is that the Protestants become very, very insecure. And they then start forming volunteer militia forces to defend themselves from Catholics in Ulster, because they fear another 1641 is round the corner, because the Dublin administration has said, we're going to roll back the plantation. So what happens then is that the Ulster Protestants then look for a saviour. They look for somebody who's going to ensure that their settlements and that their lives and their liberties and everything will become intact. And unsurprisingly, they look across to London and they see William of Orange, and they go, well, actually, with William of Orange landing, he's going to help us. So they actually appeal to William of Orange to help them. And what happens when William of Orange defeats James II at the Battle of the Boyne? It's a great victory for these Ulster Protestants because their lands, their lives and their properties in Ulster are secure. And that's why William of Orange is such a major figure for Ulster Protestants today in that sense. But even then, I doubt that the Ulster Protestants would argue that the Glorious Revolution was bloodless because, of course, they celebrate William's victory at the Battle of the Boyne. And, of course, people died at the Battle of the Boyne. So they themselves would know that the Glorious Revolution was not bloodless.
Yeah, we've since kind of just look past that, even though it's waved and flag waved and drum beaten into everybody's face. Yeah, good point. Good point.
Let's dive into this idea of it not being quite so bloodless then. And perhaps if we start with England first, how is the so-called Glorious Revolution not bloodless in England?
Well, this is the one where the major misunderstanding actually happens. People think about the Glorious Revolution in England, they definitely think it's not bloodless, and that certainly wasn't the case. Even from the sort of beginnings of the revolution, I would say that the motivations behind the Immortal Seven and their Whig allies were anything but innocent. What we have to understand is the Glorious Revolution, its foundations lie in the exiled Whig communities that live in the Netherlands under William of Orange. Now, these are not innocent people who've been prosecuted for the religion. Yes, they've been prosecuted by, you know, Charles II for being Protestant dissenters, but there's a good reason why. Because a lot of these Whig radicals in the Netherlands plotted to kill Charles II in 1683 and his brother James, Duke of York, who was later King James II, in something called the Rye House Plot. So we're not dealing here with innocent people who've been unfairly persecuted because of their religion. We're dealing here with people who are committed to overthrowing the Stuart monarchy and are committed to killing the king. And the interesting thing is, William of Orange entertains these people in his court. He allows these people to stay in the Netherlands, which I think says an awful lot about him. And not only that, he allows the Duke of Monmouth, who is the sort of illegitimate son of King Charles II, to come and live in The Hague. And the interesting thing is, it puts Charles II in this really impossible position where his son's asking him for money, you know, this typical illegitimate royal son, you know, I don't have any money, daddy, give me money, you know. Please, I need money. And
to finance my rebellion against your brother. Yeah.
And Charles II gives him money. And everybody in Britain is like, all his advisors are like, what are you doing? You shouldn't be doing this. But Charles II, you know, blood is blood. It's his son. He doesn't say no. He gives him the money. But the Duke of Monmouth is tolerated by William of Orange. And these group of people surround Monmouth, and then of course that ends up to being Monmouth's Rebellion, and we all know how that ended for Monmouth, very, very horribly.
And if you don't know, ladies and gentlemen, then go back to Steve Carter's episode on the Monmouth Rebellion, because he goes into quite some detail on it.
Yeah, so William of Orange is tolerating these people. But another thing I have to say before I get on to the actual landing of William in England is another thing we have to remember is in 1677, William of Orange married Mary, who was the eldest daughter of King James II and by Anne Hyde. So this is very much a family affair. You've got to remember, William of Orange is James II's son-in-law. So when William of Orange invades Britain, he's stabbing his own father-in-law in the back. Okay, so it's very much a family affair that's going on here, which I will explain later. So another thing we have to understand about the Glorious Revolution is that it's part of a much bigger war that's going on in Europe between Louis XIV and William of Orange, which is quite bloody, okay, called the Franco-Dutch War. But this rivalry carries on for as long as the two of them are alive. And in many ways, the Glorious Revolution is an extension of this warfare, which makes it not glorious at all, because it's part of a much wider war where people are continually getting killed. And it's all about power. It's all about military supremacy. And William's got this problem. How does he overcome the Grand Army of Louis XIV? Louis XIV had the biggest army in Europe at the time. How does William of Orange deal with this? How does he push the balance of power in his favour against Louis XIV? And I remember something that one of my lecturers said when she lectured on this in first year at university. She said that Louis XIV and William of Orange didn't care about the British and Irish people. They only cared about themselves. We were just pawns in a much, much bigger game for the two men. They didn't care about Protestants or Catholics. They didn't care about the British or Irish people. They cared about them and what Britain and Ireland meant for them. So in 1670, Louis XIV and Charles II agree to a secret treaty known as the Treaty of Dover. And as part of that, the second agrees to convert to Catholicism. And this is why Orange is seen as a paragon of the Protestant cause, because he supports the Duke of Monmouth at The Hague. With the accession of James II to the British and Irish thrones in 1685, it looks as if the power balance in Europe is swinging towards Louis XIV again. And this power struggle is essential to understanding the Glorious Revolution too, and why we have this civil war that erupts across the kingdoms. But what was William supposed to do? Well, what he did was he had Whig contacts in his court, which kept contact with the Whigs in Britain, and they reported back to him. There were secret channels. And they reported somewhat biasly that King James II was a tyrant, and he was placing Catholics in positions of trust in all levels of the state and actively ejecting Protestants. Now, we know, and as I've already discussed, King James II was very much genuine in opening doors for Catholics as well as Protestant dissenters. It's just that the Catholics just brushed in there first. And it was managed pretty poorly. But James II's heart was in the right place. Okay, he genuinely meant well. And these Whigs wrote to William and said, the English Protestant state is under threat. And it's from this very beginning that military intervention is discussed. This is not something that's organised at the last minute. This is something that is discussed relatively early on, and everything's crouched in military terms. An invasion of Britain is being planned. William will land with an army. And this is what they're planning. And for Whig historians, this is William landing with an army to liberate Britain from the tyrannical James II. He doesn't see it for what it is, in my opinion, which is a planned coup d'etat of the British state by a foreign ruler. Now, the main catalyst for William to organise this invasion, this armed invasion of Britain, was the birth of a male heir to the British throne. So on the 10th of June 1688, Mary Medina gave birth to a son, James Francis Edward Stuart. There was public rejoicing at the birth up and down the country. And interestingly, even William of Orange sent a letter of congratulations to James II on the birth of his son. However, the Whigs and William knew that William now had a problem, because the balance of power in Europe was now swinging right towards Louis XIV. How was William going to get it back? He had a real problem, because James Francis Edward Stuart was a legitimate heir. He was a legitimate heir to the British and Irish thrones. He was James II's eldest son, by his wife, Mary of Medina. Now, until that point, William's wife, Mary, was the next in line to the throne. She was Protestant. And although her mother was Anne Hyde, before the birth of James Francis Edward Stuart, Mary was the legitimate heir to the throne. So until that point, William thought he'd had everything in the bag. He thought, my wife is going to inherit the throne. We're going to be fine against Louis XIV. Everything's going to be fine. And then Mary of Medina gives birth to James Francis Edward Stuart. But what really is the instigation in all of this is that James Francis Edward Stuart is going to be brought up a Catholic.
Mm.
And, of course, William's like, oh, this is going to cause trouble in Britain, which it does. People are not happy with this. So William decides to take advantage of this. And he decides to take action to build an invasion force to go into Britain, accept the letter from the Immortal Seven, and get the throne back for his wife and for himself. Now, some historians will argue that there's no evidence that William had any plans whatsoever to take the throne for himself.
You don't assemble an army and waltz into a foreign country with a plan of regime change if it's not for you, do you?
Well, absolutely. So, unsurprisingly, I don't buy the argument that he never intended to claim the throne for himself. Of course he did, from my point of view. But I do remember reading about that when I was reading books on it. I'm thinking, no, it doesn't make any sense to me. You're absolutely right, Paul.
Yeah.
You know, this is regime change. That's what it is, regime change by armed force.
And, you know, I'm not an expert on William of Orange, by the way, but like any other 17th century man of power, he's not going to assemble this force, invade a foreign country, and then turn to his wife and go, all yours, me dear.
Absolutely. So, but interestingly, Macaulay makes a very interesting point. Even though he's a Whig historian, I just thought I'd read this because I read this and I thought it was very, very interesting. And even Macaulay has his doubts about whether William was going to instigate a civil war or not. He himself, even though he was a Whig historian, he knew the gamble that William was taking. And Macaulay, the Whig historian, writes, "But would the English people altogether, unaccustomed to the interference of continental powers in internal prospects, be inclined to look with favour on a deliverer who was surrounded by foreign soldiers? A bloody victory gained in the heart of the island of Britain by mercenaries of the Dutch States General over the Coldstream Guards and the Buffs would almost be as great a calamity as a defeat." So what he's trying to say is, even though he's biased towards William, he knows that potentially Britain's on the edge of a civil war.
So how does William handle this and what happens?
Yeah, well, on the 5th of November 1688, William of Orange lands at the English coast in Torbay and Devon, and he lands with 15,000 men, not a small amount by any means. And the majority of these people are professional soldiers. So he's not landing with, you know, a ragtag bag of mercenaries who've got, you know, poor weapons or anything. He's landing with the creme de la creme of his professional forces. He's serious about this, okay? So it consists of Dutch regulars, English and Scottish soldiers who are in his Dutch regiments in the Netherlands, and also Huguenots, okay? But they're all very professional soldiers. And make no bones about it, this is a planned invasion. This is planned with precision, and it's really well thought about. So when William lands, Britain stands, watches, and stands still. Most people in Britain don't know how to react to this. Now, we're told by Whig historiography that everybody loves William, that he was popular and you know, he was told by the Immortal Seven that he'd have lots of support if he landed. But the truth was that when William landed, majority of British people did not know what to do. They saw a clash between two titans. On one hand, you've got James II, who still has a substantial amount of men at his disposal. He has 57,000 men at his disposal, James II, and he still has London. And then you've got William of Orange, on the other hand, who has 15,000 professional soldiers making his way through Devon. And people are just sitting, watching and waiting and going, what's going to happen. Most people are paralyzed and they're just waiting to see what happens. So what happens is that James then decides to go and meet William, and he leaves London, and with 30,000 men he assembles on Salisbury Plain, waiting for William to come across from Devon. But this big battle never happens. I think everybody's expecting a big, massive battle on Salisbury Plain. It never happens. The reason why this big showdown on Salisbury Plain doesn't happen is because, as Tim Harris puts it, James is taken through in the towel. He loses his bottle. Okay. Now, some historians have criticised James for this and said he's a coward. He should have gone in for the showdown. But James is of that generation whereby he lived through the civil wars. You've got to remember that he's dealing with the sort of next generation of Whigs who are the descendants, if you like, of the Puritans that had executed his father, King Charles I. And this is very much on his mind as the news of the invasion comes through, or potential, and even before then. Because in October 1688, a month before the invasion happens, he organises it for his wife and his son to go to France for safety. And he is very, very anxious about it. And I want to quote something. James says, "It is my son that they aim at, and it is my son I must endeavour to preserve whatever becomes of me." So the execution of his father is very much on his mind, but also the fact that his brother, King Charles II, and himself had to flee during the Wars of the Three Kingdoms to the continent. This is very much at the forefront of his mind. And I think that is what prevents James having this massive clash with William of Orange on Salisbury Plain.
Mm.
However, this does not mean that between the time William of Orange lands on the 5th of November 1688 and when James flees the country in December 1688, people do not die in England as a result of the conflict. And I'm going to go through three examples of what happened. Only a period of about, 8 weeks, but people in England die. So the first episode, the first fatalities of this event take place in London. So as James is making preparations to leave London, riots start to happen. And these are very anti-Catholic riots. Catholic ambassadors have their houses overturned. The Protestant London mob goes absolutely crazy. And James II's soldiers have to restore order. And in doing so, on the 12th of November, they end up shooting 6 or 7 people dead as they're trying to restore order in London. And they're the first casualties of the 1688 revolution as order is starting to be restored. The next event where people lost their life was when James is trying to confine William to Devon, and he ends up going to Salisbury with these 30,000 men. But then William of Orange hears that James is at Salisbury and he starts moving on the 21st of November towards James. And although this major battle on Salisbury Plain didn't take place, the advance guard of both armies met at Wincanton in South Somerset, and there was an altercation. And what happened was that an officer, Officer Campbell, if you like, who was part of Mackay's regiment, who was in with William of Orange's forces, decided to raid some horses from the Irish advance guard of King James II. And as Campbell was trying to steal these horses, the Irish guard was advancing towards him. And there ended up being a clash between the two groups of soldiers. And it ended up in fatalities. I think 3 volleys of musket shots were fired by the Irish towards Mackay's regiment. Mm. And people died. And that's the second round of fatalities in the revolution in England. So people usually play it down as a skirmish. If you read any of the books on the 1688 revolution, they will mention Wincanton, they will mention Reading, which I'm about to talk about in a minute. But yeah, it's usually just a one line that there were two skirmishes and that was it. But what that hides is that people did actually die. And so Wincanton is an example that the revolution was not bloodless. The next sort of altercation between the two armies was on the 6th of December 1688 in Reading. And what happened in Reading was that you had about 200 of William of Orange's soldiers versus 600 Irish. And the 200 soldiers of William of Orange pushed the 600 Irish through the town of Reading. And as the Irish were being pushed back into the marketplace, they were getting fired on by the troops by William of Orange. But William of Orange's troops got help from the people of Reading themselves, who pelted the Irish with objects from their windows. And there were people who did die. About 50 Irish soldiers died, and about 5 soldiers belonging to William of Orange died in this altercation. So what I'm saying is that people did die as a result of the revolution in England. The revolution in England was by no means glorious in the sense it wasn't, you know, if you take glorious to mean bloodless, the revolution even in England wasn't bloodless at all. People did die. And that's something that I'm very anxious to get across.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
So William wins, James II flees, December 1688, and William III, Queen Mary, are declared monarchs. So job done? All nice and complete?
No.
I thought not.
No. Just because William has managed to grab hold of England, it doesn't mean that Ireland or even Scotland is on his side.
Oh, it never does it?
And, you know, we're back to the old Three Kingdoms thing of, you know, different nations all pulling in different directions, wanting different things. And so the potential for bloodshed is even more so in Ireland. I mean, unlike in England, full-scale battles and sieges do actually happen in Ireland, okay? And there is a lot of bloodshed that happens in Ireland between 1689 and 1691.
Mm-hmm.
So, to recap, as I've said, in Ireland, like in other parts of Britain, Catholics were returned to office. And as I've said before, the Protestants felt very insecure about this. And they looked towards William and William's landing as William as being their saviour. King James II landed in Ireland in March 1689. This is obviously after he fled London. He comes back with an army, courtesy of Louis XIV. And interestingly, Louis XIV doesn't give James his best men. James actually pleads Louis XIV to give him the Irish regiments that Louis XIV has as part of his Royal Guard. This is probably something I'm going to write in my historical fiction novel later on. Louis XIV says, on your bike, they're some of my best men. I'm going to give you Protestant Danish Lutherans instead. Now, a lot of people don't know this because they just assume, oh, it's full of lots of Catholic Frenchmen and Irish Catholics. But actually, a huge amount of James II's army was filled with Protestant Lutheran Danish soldiers because Louis XIV didn't want them anyway. So he was like, go and take them, you know. So William, so James lands with these with these men from Louis XIV, and the officer volunteers looking across, going, William, we need help. Because James has just come across with an army. So the officer volunteers then approach William of Orange and say, have you got any more men? And in contrast to Louis XIV, William of Orange actually gives the officer volunteers some pretty decent men. He gives them about 15,000 professional soldiers. And these outnumber the men that James has brought over himself. And as most people know, in July 1690, James II's army was famously defeated at the Battle of the Boyne, and it fatally wounded Catholic hopes in Ireland. James's defeat at the Boyne solidifies the Protestant ascendancy in Ireland for the next three centuries, and that's because after William wins, he cleans up the land confiscations in Ireland. He takes the last remaining 20%, 10% of land left in Catholic hands and gives it to Protestants. So the Protestants have now got all the land and they get all the top positions. Okay, and this is why it assures the Protestant ascendancy in Ireland and why, to a certain degree, William is celebrated in Ireland today. However, this does not, this long-term impact of William's victory obscures the fact that between sort of 1689 and 1691, Ireland was in a very bitter and bloody civil war between Jacobites and Williamites. And I'm just going to go through two examples quickly, which is the siege of Derry, Londonderry, and I am going to use both names for the place. As they say, Derry girls, name you use depends on your perspective, but I will use both names, just out of fairness. And the Battle of Aughrim, which is the last major battle of the Jacobite-Williamite War in Ireland, which was quite brutal as well. So King James II is very anxious about these Ulster volunteers. He wants to bring Protestant dissenters over. He feels like he's been misunderstood about what he's trying to do. And he's very anxious about the fact that you've got all these Ulster volunteers all now armed against him. So then he decides that he really needs to go to where this movement is taking place. And it's around sort of Derry, Londonderry area. And within the walls of Derry, Londonderry, there are 30,000 Protestant refugees. They're all packed in there because they're expecting another 1641 rebellion. They've all packed themselves in there. And the reason for their choice of place, not only is Derry, Londonderry, is surrounded by walls, it was the only place that Sir Phelim O'Neill, who was the instigator of the 1641 rebellion, could not penetrate. So that's why a lot of Protestant refugees went to Derry, Londonderry, okay, for shelter during this time. And the first casualties of the siege of Londonderry happen over a skirmish over a bridge. And it happens at a place called Claddy, and it's on the River Finn. And they're fighting over this bridge, because obviously in military times you have to secure your bridges. And what happens is two or three people get killed. The Jacobites win the bridge, and the Protestant soldiers run away into Derry, basically saying, you know, we're in a lot of trouble here. And then what happens is King James II hears about this and he goes, oh, hey, hang on a minute, we're getting the upper hand. Well, maybe if I approach the gates of Derry and I reason with these Protestant dissenters and tell them I'm really on their side, I'm not mean as bad as they think I am, they're going to open the gates to me. So he travels all the way from Armagh to Derry, expecting the defenders to open the gates to him. And they don't at all. In fact, the soldiers fire upon James's soldiers and they end up killing some of them. And James himself gets a bit of a fright. But James is not hard-hearted. Even at that point, he wants to reason with them and he offers them an amnesty. He says, look, you know, we can come to some agreement. And for a short period, he lets out about 1,000 people outside of Derry to show that he is actually not a bad person. He's saying, look, I am a very kind king who does care about your welfare. You know, please understand that I genuinely do care about you. But because the Jacobite army is so close to Derry, the Protestants inside just don't trust him. They think he's up to no good. So then James is like, well, I've got no choice. So he lays siege to Derry's Londonderry. And so you've got a situation where you've got 30,000 refugees all crammed into this small city behind these walls. Food's in short supply anyway, because the gates have been shut on earlier Catholic forces that tried to come to some agreement. And the what happens is, as time goes on, the conditions inside get worse. So you have 30,000 people all crammed in this walled city where food is becoming scarce, and they start eating cats and dogs. People are dying of exposure for sleeping outside because the Jacobites and the Williamites have been firing cannon shot at each other. They've taken off roofs off houses. They've destroyed buildings within Derry, Londonderry. And so people have been forced to sleep out in the cold, so people die of exposure. The dysentery is rife. Women and children are dying of dysentery on a large scale. And it is a major humanitarian crisis. We would see it in that light today, because between 8,000 and 10,000 people, and that's almost a third of the number of people within the walls, died or starved to death within the walls of Derry, until William's soldiers came to relieve the siege on the 30th of July, 1689.
So wow.
You can't say that the 1688 revolution was bloodless. I'm going to skip over the Battle of the Boyne. And the reason for that is, I know it's a major battle in the whole war in Ireland, but the casualties were quite minimal compared to other conflicts in this civil war. So I'm moving straight towards the Battle of Aughrim, which takes place in 1691, okay? And this is the last big showdown between the forces of William of Orange and the Jacobites. Now, by this time, William of Orange and King James have had their big bun fight at the Battle of the Boyne. James has fled. But for the next year, these armies all still are coming in contact with each other and they're still fighting. But Aughrim is the last big showdown, and it actually destroys the Jacobite forces to the point where they can't recover. And this happens in July 1691. So what happens is, the Jacobite commander, St. Ruth, he decides that he wants a showdown with the Williamites. And he picks the site of a field outside the settlement of Aughrim in County Galway. Now, the other commanders are arguing with him and saying, no, this is a bad idea. We're better to play it defensively because we still have some of the towns in our possession. We don't really want a big field battle. But St. Ruth was convinced that he could push the Williamites all the way back to Dublin. He was really convinced of the strength of the Jacobite forces at this time. So each army between them had 20,000 men. Okay, so they were eeksy peeksy in terms of numbers. Jacobite morale was a bit shaky, so St. Ruth decides, well, I'm going to organise Catholic mass and to lift their spirits. And to give you some sense of the sort of scale of the carnage before we get right into it, a Catholic bishop reported back after the battle that at least 80 priests were slaughtered during the battle, just as they were trying to encourage the men to fight. And these priests were obviously the same priests that had given these men mass, because the battle took place on a Sunday. It took place on Sunday, the 12th of July, 1691. That was another reason for mass, that it was a Sunday, and St. Ruth thought, I'll boost their morale, I'll give them Catholic mass. And as I say, it was huge to give you a taste of the carnage before I go into it, at least 80 priests lost their life during the battle, just trying to encourage the Jacobite forces to fight. The Williamite forces saw St. Ruth's drop his lines and they decided to attack at 5 p.m. on the Sunday. The battle was a mass of confusion. Even a leading historian on the subject, G.G. Sims, says that all the accounts of the battle are widely different. But what he did say was that for the first 2 hours of the battle, they were just skirmishes. Nobody really was fully committed to going in and doing anything much. And then, and it's at that point where they're just skirmishing that St. Ruth gets a bit cocky, the Jacobite officer, Jacobite commander, and he's like, well, you know, this isn't going to turn out much. I can push the Williamites all the way back to Dublin. We're going to be home and dry, boys. And but the battle very quickly turned against the Jacobite. And I think this is fascinating. So Ginkell, the Williamite commander at Aughrim, decided to send in reinforcements. And as St. Ruth saw these reinforcements appear, he decided to reorganise his cavalry. As St. Ruth was reorganising his cavalry, a cannon shot came in and literally ripped St. Ruth's head from his shoulders. And the Jacobite cavalry, as a result, lost, well, the Jacobite army had lost their major commander. Mm. The Jacobite cavalry just went into utter confusion. Command just dissolved. And there was this pass that the Jacobites controlled on the battlefield. And as a result of this confusion, the Jacobites lost control of this pass. And before they knew it, the Williamites were all over them. And as a result, they were getting absolutely decimated. The infantry collapsed. And the garrison, the Jacobite garrison that held Aughrim Castle, was absolutely butchered by the Williamites. So they were absolutely destroyed. In fact, it is the worst death toll in Irish military history. Over 7,000 Jacobites lost their lives. And as I say, this is the worst death toll in Irish military history. 7,000 people, and the entire Jacobite army was decimated. There is no way that you can call the 1688 revolution as being bloodless. This was just carnage. This was just mayhem.
So we've looked at England and Ireland, but how did the revolution play out in Scotland?
So what we have to understand about Scotland is that, contrary to England, James the Seventh, as he's known in Scotland, was very, very popular. He'd done a good job governing Scotland for his brother when he was Duke of York between 1680 and 1682. And he'd instituted a policy whereby Catholics and Presbyterians were given office, and he did a very good job because Lord Stair was promoted into office by James, Duke of York, as he was then, or later King James VII. Okay, so James had enacted this policy of toleration, and it actually bore fruit in Scotland, whereby Presbyterians and Catholics held office. So it did actually come to fruition. Also, another thing you have to understand about the revolution in Scotland is that Scotland had no say in the letter from the Immortal Seven in England. The Immortal Seven were Englishmen, and they'd sent that letter thinking only about England. They weren't really thinking about the other two kingdoms, which will not surprise people who are familiar with Whigs and Puritans. They're very, very Anglo-centric. That's what you have to understand. When the Whigs send this letter to William of Orange, they are thinking only about England. So Scotland doesn't really react to events until James flees. And what happens is Scotland calls a convention. And in this convention is split equally between people who like James and people who like Orange. It's not like England, where England goes over to Orange almost wholesale. There is actually a split. But what is very interesting is there's a clique called the Club, and they consist of Whigs and They have links to the Earl of Argyll, mm-hmm. who obviously has been in exile in the Netherlands and has been living with William of Orange. And they rise up in the convention and they start to control proceedings. And they demand a Presbyterian church and they demand a re-established parliament. They take control of the situation. And they declare, to the club's instigation, they declare that James has forfeited his right to the crown in Scotland because he has fled. You know, James didn't yeah. sign a formal abdication. They've just said, well, he's fled, so, you know, he's no longer king. And then they invite William of Orange and Mary to take the crown of Scotland, which they do on the 11th of May, 1689. So the revolution in Scotland's got a slightly different flavour to it. But the interesting thing is, 10 weeks after William and Mary accept the crown in Scotland, Scotland erupts into civil war between Jacobites and Williamites. And again, like Ireland, this is full-scale battles. This is a conflict where people, you know, a lot of people die. I'm not going to go through all the battles and all the conflicts, obviously, because we don't have time for it. But, you know, this civil war lasts until the 1st of May 1690, until the Jacobite forces are destroyed at the Battle of Cromdale. But what I will do is I will talk about the Battle of Killiecrankie and also mm-hmm. something very close to my heart, which is technically seen sort of outside the sort of Williamite Jacobite war in Scotland, but it is nevertheless connected, which is the massacre of Glencoe. Okay. So Battle of Killiecrankie. So this is quite interesting. So Battle of Killiecrankie was a victory for the Jacobites, and it's quite an interesting victory because John Graham of Claverhouse, Viscount Dundee, only has 1,700 men at his disposal. And he sees off a much larger Williamite force. And, I mean, I can imagine people saying, going, how or why, how did that happen? And the root of this is the famous Highland Charge. And what happened was that the Williamite commander at the time had spread his lines too thin. To a certain degree as well, the Williamites were kind of caught off guard. Dundee appeared and then, you know, the Williamites appeared and then they sort of decided hastily, let's have a battle. And what happened was that the Jacobites organised themselves into their Highland Charge. And this is absolutely terrifying for the Williamite soldiers. The Highland Charge was something that was feared by their enemies. It was ruthless on one ground, but it always seemed to work. I mean, one occasion where it didn't work and it was broken was Culloden. I won't go into it, but, you know, that it's a very famous, you know, episode where it didn't work. But
I believe they had to, if I'm remembering Culloden right, and I know how nervous I am talking to a Scot about Culloden here, but as I understand it, they had to actually go into specific training to find a weakness in the Highland yeah. Charge and yeah. exploit it. But the first yeah. time you face that, you're not yeah. going to know.
Yeah, so Cumberland had researched, you know, how, you know, he had to research this and he came up with a plan of lines sort of quite, you know, a certain number deep. So that when the Highland Charge came through, it didn't break the lines. Fortunately, the Williamite commander in charge of this operation didn't do that. He spread his lines too thinly. And he'd warned his troops, if you dare break, he says, the surrounding clans in the surrounding area in Perthshire and the Earl of Athol's men are going to slit your throats. So do not run and do not flee. But as soon as the Highlanders and the Jacobites screamed at the Williamite soldiers, some of the Williamite soldiers were so terrified, they just broke and ran. And it was chaos. It was a bloodbath. And as part of the Highland Charge, as soon as the Jacobites were on these men, they butchered them. They slaughtered them where they stood. And it was a bloodbath. And there's this very famous story of all these soldiers fleeing the battlefield, these Williamite soldiers fleeing the battlefield. And you've probably heard of this really superhuman feat by one Williamite soldier of jumping across the river from high cliffs. Even when we look at it today, we wonder how the hell did he manage to clear, you know, jumping from, you know, this cliff right away across to the other side. But when your life's at risk, it's incredible what you'll do, you know, how far you can jump. It's quite a famous episode. So, as I say, it was a very brutal, very, very brutal battlefield. And as I say, that in itself shows that the 1688 revolution was not bloodless. It was very, very much a civil war. It was very much a conflict where people lost their lives. And, you know,
yeah,
aggressively so as well.
Okay, and then you're going to go for the one that I believe has got a personal connection there, and that is then the massacre of Glencoe, which, as Kyle pointed out before we recorded, was ordered by Scots, performed by Scots on other Scots.
Yes, absolutely. It's something I emphasise because a lot of people tend to get the wrong end of the stick, and, you know, I've seen on Twitter people, you know, British Army this, British Army that. No, it wasn't. It was the Scottish Army. It was paid by the Scottish government. It was the Scottish Army. It was Scottish people doing it to Scottish people. And Kyle's absolutely right. And it's something I have to pull people up on all the time. But it is a very, very tragic story. But I think it also shows how vindictive William of Orange could really, really be. And this is where I get really angry in that sense. So the Jacobite army is eventually destroyed at Cromdale on the 1st of May 1690. However, William of Orange was not just satisfied with defeating the Jacobites militarily. He wanted people to swear loyalty to him and his wife as well, okay, particularly the clans. And he devised an oath that they all had to take by the 31st of December 1691. Now, unfortunately, when this oath was administered, it was at the height of winter in the Scottish Highlands, and at this time the winter was particularly bad. And many of the clan chiefs that were asked to comply just did it in the nick of time. But the story of McKeon of Glencoe is a very, very sad one, because he was full of really good intentions. He'd got the missive to pledge loyalty to William and Mary. He decided that he would leave his clan and go to Fort William to take the oath, only to be told by Colonel Hill, the governor of Fort William, that he'd come to the wrong place. Now, he arrived at Fort William on the deadline on the 31st of December 1691. And so, unsurprisingly, McKeon was all in a bit of state. He's thinking, I've come to the wrong place. I'm going to be late taking the oath. So he asks Hill for a letter to say he's obviously well-intentioned, that he intended to take the oath, and he's hoping that this letter from Hill gives him a reprieve. Where McKeon was supposed to go is he was supposed to go to Inverary, which is in Argyll, which is quite a ways.
The other side of Scotland,
the other side of Scotland. So he's got to travel down the Great Glen and he's got to travel down the west coast of Scotland. He eventually gets there on the 3rd of January 1692. But unfortunately, Archinglass, who is the administrator of the oath, has left, and McKeon's all in a bit of a state. He's like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? So he finds Archinglass eventually, explains the situation, takes out Hill's letter, and Archinglass says, okay, fine, I'll take your oath, sign this, I'll give you a certificate, we'll send this off to Edinburgh, and we'll say no more about it. Now, Archinglass was a Campbell, okay? This is another thing you've got to keep in mind, in the back of your mind. I'm not going to accuse him of anything, because I don't think there's any evidence for skullduggery, but Archinglass is a Campbell, okay? So Campbell says, so Archinglass says to him, right, I'll fill in this certificate to say you've taken the oath, I'll send the certificate off to Edinburgh and that's it, you're fine. So McKeon breathes a sigh of relief. He thinks, right, that's it, everything's fine. And he toddles off back to Glencoe. Unfortunately, a few weeks later, it's declared by the administration in Edinburgh that the certificate is seen as invalid and that the oath was taken late. Now, to understand why this is the case, this is where I think the skullduggery starts, because Dalrymple of Stair had been told by William that William wanted to make an example of the clans. And Stair was just waiting for one clan to drop the ball so that he could use them as an example to enforce loyalty to William and the Highlands. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually says to William in a letter that we should separate out McKeon from the rest of the clans. And it's clear that he is targeting McKeon as his sort of example in that sense. So at this time, what's going on is that a regiment from Argyll is going through Glencoe, and they're led by Campbell of Glenlyon. And what is normal for regiments back then is, okay, they're Campbells, the Glencoe, the Keynes are MacDonalds, but it's Highland hospitality. If there are soldiers passing through the Highlands and they need food and they need shelter and they need to be fed, it's Highland hospitality that you give people food, okay? Regardless of clan rivalries or anything, mm-hmm. you look after people, because the Highlands are a harsh climate. People wouldn't survive otherwise. So it's part of Highland culture to do this. So Campbell of Glenlyon and his men are in Glencoe for a number of weeks up at this point. They've lived with these people. They've shared their food. They've been given warmth. They've entertainment. They've been well looked after as per Highland hospitality. Then Campbell of Glenlyon gets this letter in the middle, well, in round about the 12th, the 13th of February, 1692. And this letter reads that none of the women and children, the young and the old, are to be spared. And what Campbell of Glenlyon has been ordered to do is to attack the MacDonalds of Glencoe at 5 a.m. in the morning while they're sleeping in their beds and kill them, because Stair wants to make an example of these people. Now, bear in mind, I have to remind you, McKeon did take the oath to William of Orange.
Yeah.
He was slightly late, but he did do it, and it was well-intentioned. And also I have to emphasise is that McKeon did not take place in the Jacobite intrigues that happened the previous autumn. He wasn't a suspect. He wasn't seen as a bad guy, generally. He wasn't one of the really naughty Jacobites. He was actually one of the good guys, okay? So when he took that oath to William, he was actually quite sincere, okay? And what happens is that Glenlyon looks at the order, and I can't imagine what is going through his head. Because as a professional soldier, he knows that he is being ordered to kill non-combatants, innocent non-combatants. But if he does not follow that order, he will be shot for insubordination. So he's in a really, really difficult position. And he's sort of, he organises himself and he organises his men. And McKeon sort of is woken up with a noise and he comes out and he says, what's going on? And Campbell of Glenlyon says to him, oh, it's okay. We've got some trouble, you know, over in that part. I think we're going to leave and we're going to go and see what's going on. McKeon had no inkling of what was going on. And as McKeon was getting dressed, one of Glenlyon's soldiers shot McKeon in the back, and that was the start of the Glencoe massacre. And what happened is that women and children were butchered in their beds. Soldiers even used the butts of their rifles to smash the skulls of some of the McDonald's. Women were stripped naked and left in the snowy hills, and a lot of them died of exposure. There is absolutely no way that you could justify that as being within the rules of combat. Not even by, you know, 17th century standards.
Yeah.
This is way off the scale in terms of that. And I get quite emotive about it. And the reason why I get quite emotive about it is that I am descended from McDonald's, who are from the Cairngorms, which is east of Glencoe. But the oral history that's been passed down through our family is that we are descendants of one of the survivors of the massacre of Glencoe, because a lot of the survivors fled over the hills and fled in different directions. And some of them probably fled to safety across the Cairngorms. So that's why I'm very passionate. When people tell me that 1688 revolution was bloodless, I get very, very angry, because when you look at the Glencoe massacre, there is no way that you can even say that the 1688 revolution was bloodless.
Well, thank you very much, Kirsty. That was epic. And it again comes from an area that, being English, yeah, you kind of buy into that whole glorious revolution invite, and you never really consider the brutal civil war that happened elsewhere. I can be just as guilty of that. So thank you very much, because that's shone an absolutely brilliant light on a conflict that we really should talk more about. So it's been an honour and privilege, but thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
You are absolutely welcome. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you would like to know more about Kirstine's work, then you can start by buying the first of her 7 books, La Garde Écossaise, and we will have links to that in the show notes. And, of course, listening to the accompanying podcast as well that will go through the history, we will have a link to that in the show notes as well. And, of course, you can follow her on Twitter at KirstineMM. But, yeah, once again, thank you very much for coming back. And I'm sure that you've got enough rage to come back a third time at some point. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. We would really appreciate any reviews you could leave for us with Apple, Podchaser, or Amazon. You can follow us on Twitter at History Rage, or individually, I am at Paul Bavel.
And I am at Kyle G History.
And if you're enjoying this, then please join the Angry Mob on Patreon, because this really helps support our podcast. Your £5 per month will get you early episodes, entry into all of our prize draws, the invite to put questions to future guests, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/History Rage. But until next week, from all of us here, stay angry. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.